I'm Brent, single dad to my two little girls. Going through my divorce, I lost almost everything. I feel like I'm not able to provide what my kids deserve, and I don't have the money to build things back up to normal.
And that is one of the things that we cover here. All this month, we are talking about my favorite subject, finances. Just kidding. If you know anything about me, it is not. But it is something that we need to talk about, so I'm glad that we're doing it. But before we get into it, I want to remind you to subscribe on any podcast platform that you are using. We recommend Access More because it's the best. But if you don't have that, wherever you get your podcasts, hit that subscribe button and download our new app so you are in touch with us constantly. And I don't mean that in a creepy way. We don't track you or anything, but you'll have access to our podcasts and our devotions and access to our online groups from wherever you're at. So it's really, really cool. I'm so excited for our conversation today. We have a very special guest, and we're talking about how to live more with less.
When I look at all the things and opportunities that other parents are able to provide for their kids, I can't help but feel like I'm failing. I hate being in the position I can't give my kids or even myself what we need.
I'm Robert Beeson. I'm the founder of Solo Parent Society. And because of firsthand experience, I want to say to you right now, you're not alone. This society was created by solo parents as a place and now a podcast for you to begin to heal, connect with others, and to start to believe that there's hope. I can tell you firsthand that your life can be fuller, your relationships can be richer, and you can overcome all that you've lost. Welcome to the Solo Parent Society podcast. So you've experienced enough surprise in your life, like we say every week. We don't want to give you another surprise. We want to lay out for you what we're going to be doing so you know what to expect from this episode. So to do that, I'd like to introduce you to my lovely and talented co-host.
Surprise!
Kimberly Mitchell.
Kim. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm really, really good. We've had a full day today.
We have had a full day, but it's good stuff. It's kind of like brain.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Like not overload because it's amazing information and amazing guests that we've been able to talk to today, but
it's just a lot. It's like drinking from a fire hose.
I know. It's kind of like, I'm like, I just need to go home and really
digest all of it.
Yeah,
I agree.
Totally. So it's all so good. And we're so glad that you are here with us and that we get to do this together. And we're going to dive into this topic today. And it's not always an easy one, talking about money and living on less and all that stuff, but we're going to do it. And sometimes we get personal real quick. Both Robert and I were single parents for over 8 years. And on these episodes, we deal with deep and sometimes hard things. But oh, I love this part. We know that we will always end in a place of hope.
That's right. One of the things that's super important for you to know, and this won't be a surprise because I say this every week, is that if you are doing something exciting like parasailing or wrestling tigers or something like that, and you're listening to this podcast, you're going, man, I don't have a free arm to push pause. And that was a really cool thought. Don't worry. Don't stop wrestling the tiger. Keep doing that and know that all the insights and information that we talk about will be there for you in your show notes. So check that out. So there's so much that has changed about the way we single parents live compared to the way we used to. Yeah. Often we compare our lives to what we used to have and what we see other people having. Feeling a sense of loss about not having enough or, frankly, not being enough can be very discouraging and disheartening. So we're excited today, as we're talking about finances this month, one component of that is how to stretch our money, live more simply, and I'm so excited to be joined today by Joshua Fields Milburn. He is one half of this movement called The Minimalist, who have helped over 20 million people live meaningful lives through less, and they do that through their website, books, podcasts, and Netflix documentary. They've been featured on the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, Forbes, Time, ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox. I could go on.
I know. It's
they
amazing.
They have been everywhere.
Yeah.
But I watched this Netflix documentary called The Minimalist, and it's all about really stripping things down to the essentials. And so we thought it would be useful and insightful for single parents when you are living in a place of feeling like you already have less than you used to reframe that and to somehow appreciate the things that you've got and find ways to live simply moving forward. So let's get into our conversation with Josh. Josh, we're so glad you're here. Thanks for taking time.
Hey, thank you.
So talk to us about what compelled you to live into a dramatically simplified way of living called minimalism.
You know, sometimes it takes a car crash to realize that maybe you were driving irresponsibly.
Yes.
And for me, I sort of had two car crashes back to back. My mother died, my marriage ended both in the same month. And those two events really forced me to look around and start to question what had become my life's focus. You know, I was ostensibly successful. I grew up really poor and thought the way that I could become happy was to make a lot of money. And so I spent all of my 20s working 80 hours a week climbing the corporate ladder. And I was sort of living this idea of the American dream. But along with that came a lot of irresponsible habits that I carried on throughout my 20s. Yeah. I racked up a lot of debt. I was spending more money than I made. I was more focused on so-called success and achievement. And in our society, you know that that means the accumulation of stuff.
And if
I just get one more thing, then I'll be happy, right? And I realized, like, well, this wasn't working, right? The things that were supposed to make me happy had actually become the objects of my discontent in a lot of ways. The average American household has 300,000 items in it. And I probably had more than that.
Wow.
And I wasn't a hoarder. Like when you go on, you turn on the TV, you see people living with stuff all over the floors. I was a well-organized hoarder, right? I had boxes and bins and a whole ordinal alphabetized system of stuff. And it was a way for me to excuse my own hoarding, my own problem, trying to fill the void with stuff. But of course, the stuff never filled the void. It only widened it.
Yeah.
Totally. I remember one time, I'm just going to throw this in there. My son and my daughter, we were watching The Hoarders on TV. And actually, my son looked at me and goes, "Well, Mom, I guess our rooms don't look too bad now, do they?" Like, nope, not too bad. So it helps to have it a little bit organized. So can you just tell me, I'm so fascinated by all that you do and are teaching, but why is your core message of living more deliberately with less? Why is that so important?
Well, I think you just said something that it helps to be a little bit organized, but I think that the best way to organize your stuff is to get rid of
it. Right.
Right. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not a monk or an ascetic. I'm not against things. In fact, I'm not even against consumption. I don't think consumption is the problem. I think consumerism is the problem, the sort of unintentional consumption, the obligatory or compulsory consumption that we have steeped ourselves in the society, the sort of overindulgence. You know, This whole message of minimalism struck me right after the financial crisis of 2008. I think what we were all beginning to realize around that time was, I've racked up all this debt and I've accumulated all of these things. And maybe that would be okay if it was radically increasing my joy or satisfaction or well-being. It was actually doing the opposite. The things that I thought were important were actually getting in the way of what was truly important.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, I'm thinking the 2008 crash, it had a pretty significant effect on a number of areas of my life. But as you were talking, I'm thinking about what we're facing right now in this pandemic as being a crash of sorts where we're forced into a different way of living, which forces us to evaluate, you know, it wouldn't be the same as like we've accumulated so much stuff, but certainly we occupied ourselves with so many things and we pushed our kids into so many functions and activities that we weren't really present in a lot of them. And so this, in a way, these, like you were saying, car crashes stock crashes or a pandemic have a way to kind of reorient. We talk about often with Solo Parent Society, is both Kim and I were single parents for, you know, 8.5 years and raising our kids alone. And it was really, really difficult, but that season really reset a lot of stuff in our lives and reoriented me to what I'd been in the music business for a long time and, you know, racked up all the accolades that I could possibly want in that field. But it didn't save my marriage. It didn't save things that were important to me. And so car crashes, stock crashes, COVID can certainly have a way of resetting ourselves. Talk to us about how you define, you talk about in the documentary, how you define bringing value to your life related to what we let go of or keep, because I feel like we assign equal value to almost all of our stuff.
We sure do. And that makes it pretty difficult to get started, right? When you're so overwhelmed because you look around. And I think this is especially true now during COVID and people spending more time at home. Many people are even working from home.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone is really looking back and saying, oh, I really wish I would have kept that third grade basketball trophy now that I'm spending more time at home. Yes. I've had people reach out to me and ask, like, are you upset now that you got rid of so much stuff and now there's this pandemic, especially when it first started? And no, I don't miss the broken waffle iron, right? Yes. Like, it just, there are so many things that were getting in the way. And I'm actually really grateful that I got rid of those things, because you asked that question, how do you determine what adds value to your life? Well, I like to say, as a minimalist, everything I own serves a purpose or it brings me joy. And so when you think about it that way, if something adds value to my life, that means it serves a purpose, meaning it has some sort of function. It's a tool in some way, but I'm not completely utilitarian either. Mm-hmm. So when I say something brings me joy, you know, I think beauty is essential. I think art is essential. I think there are certain parts of life. Music is essential. There are certain things for us that will bring joy to our lives, even if they're not strictly a functional tool. And so I have to be honest with myself because we can justify anything. I can say anything adds value to my life. But I've actually set up some rules as a consequence, because I know that because I can justify anything, I need to be really careful about what I bring into my life and then also what I hold on to. So Ryan and I have like 16 different rules. We have we have this free ebook on
it's
our
on your website.
Website.
I downloaded it. Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, and so it's just called the Minimalist Rulebook, 16 Rules for Living with Less. But what we've done is we've shared our recipe. They're not steadfast rules. They're adjustable rules. I'll give you a couple examples. This will give you an idea of what's in there. One is called the just in case rule. I don't know if you're anything like me, but you justify, I at least justify holding on to a lot of things just in case I might need it someday in some non-existent hypothetical future.
Yes.
And man, it's so easy to justify anything at that point. Oh, don't worry, I'll just hold on to that just in case. Well, I've learned that just in case are the three most dangerous words in the English language. And so we came up with this just in case rule. It's also known as the 2020 rule, because I've realized if I let something go because I'm holding on to it just in case, I know I can replace it for $20, less than $20, less than 20 minutes from wherever I am.
Huh.
Now, that might sound like a rule of privilege at first. Like, oh, who wants to go around spending $20 a day on all of these things? And I agree with you. If that were the case, I wouldn't recommend it. Mm-hmm. But Ryan and I, over the last decade now that we've been doing The Minimalists, we've had to use that rule between us five times. And what that shows me is that most of the things we're holding on to, just in case, we don't actually need at all. And so, yeah, maybe I've spent upwards of $80 or $100 over the last 10 years, but that $80 or $100 has given me permission to let go of tens of thousands of just-in-case items. I'll give you one more rule real quick that's really helped me out. We call it the seasonality rule, and also known as the 90-90 rule. I like to throw some numbers in here. So pick up any item in your house and be honest with yourself. Have I used this in the last 90 days? And if not, ask myself a second question. Will I use it in the next 90 days? And if not, then I give myself permission to let go. Now, seasonality, obviously that covers all four seasons. If, you know, it's fall and you're looking at... You're looking at, did I use it in the summer? Okay. Am I using it right now? No. Am I going to use it in the winter? Well, I guess that covers all seasons. I'm good to go. Now, you can change the parameters there. Maybe 90-90 is a little too extreme for you. No problem. Make it a one-year rule, whatever is applicable to your life. But it allows you to realize what things you're actually using, what things you're getting value from, and what is just... is aping the form of value, but it's really taking up space, precious space, not just in your home, but in your mind.
That's so good and so practical.
Listen, I'm feeling a little bit good about myself because I don't like to hold on to lots of stuff. I'm a preacher's kid, so we moved so many times in my life that really, I just never really hung on to anything. I have like one little box for my kids because I'm not sentimental, I guess. And I don't like to hang on to stuff, and I get rid of clothes all the time.
That's
but,
the one thing. Can I ask you, Josh? Like, I am not a hoarder. Well, I don't think I am. Maybe I am. But I have like a memory box plus for each one of my daughters.
Sure.
And they're cram-packed with stuff. And then I was cleaning out a closet a few weeks ago, and I'm like, there were so many beautiful notes that my daughters wrote to me and, you know, just things here and there. Like,
take a picture.
Well, that's kind of where I'm going, how do you, you know, I feel sentimentally attached and it does bring me joy, but honestly, there's a bunch of these carvings and clay pigeons or whatever zombies that were made, you know, as crafts that I'm holding on to. And someone said to me the other day, like, when I pass, if I give these to my daughters, they're probably not going to want them. So I'm holding on to some ideal. How do you answer people that are going, you know, but I'm just, these have such sentimental value. I couldn't possibly get rid of an artifact that my daughter created when she was three, or, you know, incorporated her first tooth into some kind of,
Does that go along with the justifying? We can justify keeping anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain things that are certainly worth holding on to. The lesson that I learned throughout all of this is, well, a few things. I would never recommend starting with the sentimental items.
Right.
You need some sort of momentum in order to get going. Within that minimalist rule book I explained to you, there's another rule in there. It's really a tactic. It's called the 30-day minimalism game. And what we encourage people to do is start small. Start with the easy things. You know, we've all had that oversized orange sweatshirt with tassels in the back of our closet that no one's wearing. You have clothes that you probably hate. And I start with that because letting go feels freeing. And the more you do it, the lighter you feel, the freer you feel, becoming untethered to the stuff. So don't start with the sentimental items, but I totally get it. The sentimental items, we assign meaning to things. Although I don't think our things are inherently meaningful. They're not. They have only the meaning we assign to them. And so, of course, you might have a possession. There's an old bit from George Carlin. He's talking about how come all of my stuff is crap to everyone else, and everyone else is, you know. That's kind of how it is, right? Like, we look at someone else's thing, look at that crap, and they look at our stuff, and they're like, look at that. But for us, we've made it precious. The problem with that is if everything is precious, then nothing's precious. And so when we water down our sentimental items with dozens or hundreds or thousands of sentimental trinkets, I found that I actually get far less value than if I were to keep a small handful of sentimental items that I can reference, that I can go back to, that I can get joy from because I'm sharing that experience or I'm able to go back to it with some regularity. And that gives me permission to let go of the other ones. Because also, remember, our memories are not in our things. Our memories are inside us. And so no matter what you let go of, you can still retain the memories that we assign to those things because the memory was never in there in the first place. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes we need things to trigger the memories inside us. So you brought up a really good point. Why not just take a picture of it? I did that with a lot of my mother's stuff when she passed. Instead of holding on to, you know, a giant armoire or, you know, a couch or something, I have a picture of that if I ever want to reference it. And oh, by the way, it's not just a physical picture. It's digitized. It's stored in the cloud. And so if anything were to happen, if my house were to burn down or something, it's still going to be backed up. So I still have access to it.
Yeah, I was a single mom for about 8 years and pretty much lost everything when I became a single mom. And my kids and I lived in a little 800 square foot apartment with not very much stuff because I had very little money. And now, you know, I'm remarried, where life is good. We do have more things now, but my kids, and they're 16 and 19 now, their favorite place we ever lived and the most precious memories are always in that little teeny tiny apartment where we had very little, but we lived a big life. Like, we did tons of things. And that's what they remember about that season. They don't remember that every single piece of furniture I had was from the thrift store, and they didn't care. But it was the stuff we did in that season, I feel like, but they always reference that. But you know what? Society, like, and I, this happens to me too. Like, I, more than Robert, I like to give things, like, I like to get rid of stuff. But I do get caught up, especially like on things like Instagram and all these influencers in the, oh, that's a beautiful sweater. I need that. Like, and I don't need it, but we are discontent. I think there's an underlying discontent in society. And why do you think that is and what's causing that? And man, I just feel like I feel it all the time. And I don't like that part of myself, actually.
Yeah, I think we need to distinguish between mimetic beliefs and personal beliefs, right? And there's this idea of mimetic beliefs. I think it was Rene Girard who came up with this idea of like most of our beliefs are actually just influenced by society or culture or now I think the most pernicious one is advertisements.
We're
bombarded with anywhere from 3,000 to 10,000 advertisements a day, depending on where you live. That happens so much that you don't even notice the vast majority of them. But of course, they're still influencing you. That's the mimetic belief. And so the question that I often ask myself is that what you believe or did someone else tell you to believe it? And, you know, obviously with your kids and the experience in the 800 square foot apartment, it lacked a certain ego to it, because when we buy the really, you know, the fancy thing or the, you know, the purse with all of the logos on it. And by the way, this isn't a judgment on that. What I'm simply saying is that we are rarely doing that for ourselves. We're doing it to impress upon someone else to say, this is the type of person that I am. I'm unique just like everyone else. And of course, that's not the way to be to be unique or to be significant. The way that we're significant is through our actions. And there, you know, we try to buy these shortcuts, but of course there are no shortcuts. There are only direct paths. And when I look at someone who lived in a small apartment like that with fewer resources, I think minimalism applies even more in scenarios like that, because I grew up really poor, food stamps, government assistance in Dayton, Ohio. Wow. And you know what? We weren't very good with the few resources we had. We had bad habits, right?
Right.
And so, of course, when I got into my 20s, I made more money, but I continued carrying the bad habits forward into my 20s. And so making more money simply amplified my bad decisions. And so obviously we all know that money isn't inherently evil or bad. Yeah, I'm certainly not allergic to money, but it will simply amplify the habits and the decisions we are making right now. If we're generous when we make $22,000 a year, we'll be generous if we make $22 million a year.
That's true.
And it just gives us more of the ability to do so.
That's good. One of the quotes that I wrote down from your Netflix show was from a guy named Patrick Roan. I think that's his name. He's the author of Enough. I want to read this because it really popped out to me. He said, you think more money will give you more security. The problem is you don't have control over making more. The thing you do have control over is spending less. You do have control over having less. And by having less, you automatically stretch what you do have. So what I thought was really, I mean, it's so simple, right? Okay. I mean, this is so obvious, but it's so difficult sometimes to move in that direction. This month on the podcast, we're talking about money and finances for single parents. And so what are some practical ways that we can curb the appetite for more and live more deliberately with what we've got?
I found, in terms of practical ways, I think we want to start in our homes, right? We look at the stuff that we have and realize that our physical possessions, our material possessions, are a physical manifestation of what's going on inside us. So when we look at the stuff, if there's a bunch of clutter in our homes, guess what's going on inside? Mental clutter, spiritual clutter, emotional clutter, financial clutter. We just have all of this clutter that is bombarding us inside. And by dealing with the outward clutter, that physical manifestation of what's going on inside, we're able to start looking inward and saying, oh, I am enough. I am complete in an empty room. And thus, the new things I bring into my life, I should do so only when they augment, amplify, enhance my experience of life. They help me live more deliberately. And I think what we realize is there are very few things that we need and many things that we want. In fact, the rule book I mentioned earlier, we have a rule called the no junk rule. The way that I look at it is, if you look around your home, I think everything that you own, every single thing you own, can be placed in one of three piles. That first pile is the essential pile. Mm-hmm. The second pile is non-essential. The third pile is junk. Now, the essentials are the true essential. We all have pretty similar essentials. Food, mm-hmm. clothing, shelter, and it may change as our life changes. Of course, you need more space if you have four people or six people mm-hmm. living in a home than if you're a bachelor living on your own, right?
Yeah.
When I first discovered minimalism, my marriage had just ended. I didn't have any kids at the time. And so my life looked different at age 29 than it does 39 now, where mm-hmm. I'm married with a kid and uh-huh. we live in a different city. And so as your life changes, be willing to bring new things in if they're appropriate, but also be willing to let go of the things that once added value. The things that added value yesterday may not add value today, so right. I need to be willing to let go. Mm-hmm. So essentials, where they're all pretty much the same. Then you have non-essentials. Non-essentials are the things that aren't absolutely essential, but they add value to your life. And truth be told, those are the things that should make up most of our possessions. Hmm. They're not essential, but they enhance our life in some way. Unfortunately, most of our things actually fall into that third pile, the junk pile. And so we buy something thinking that it will add value to our lives because it looked great on that mannequin yeah. or it looked really good in the freestanding insert or the magazine ad.
Right.
And so we acquired it, and then it probably didn't add any value, but even if it did, it stopped adding value at some point. But of course, because of the sunk cost fallacy and some other psychological issues, we hold on to things. We cling to things instead of letting go, and they turn into junk over time. And what I would argue is that if something is junk, we should let it go, because I'm not against having some stuff, mm-hmm. even some non-essential stuff. I want some of those things, but I don't want the junk that's getting in the way.
Mm-hmm. That's good. And so one of the things that you said, you're married now and you have a kid, right? I don't know how old,
seven.
So at some point you're going to get to the place where your son or daughter is going to be comparing and looking at everybody around and stuff. And how do you guide your kids through like at least where we live here in Nashville or Franklin, Tennessee? It's fairly affluent and, you know, everyone's comparing, do you have this brand? Do you have that brand? And to go without is depravity. And obviously I know that it's not, and we should teach our kids the value of things and stuff, but has your view changed any since you started this movement to now that you're raising a kid and you know that you're going to be, you know, ask some tough questions that they haven't had a chance to really process? How has that changed, or has it, your outlook?
Yeah. You know, minimalism is a lot more difficult with a family, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's so much more important with a family as well.
I would imagine so, right. Mm-hmm.
Because we all have the same 24 hours in a day. We all know that platitude. But mm-hmm. how I get to spend those hours are often dictated by what I prioritize. You know, this word priority, it didn't have a plural until the 20th century. It's a very American thing for us to do, right? And don't get me wrong, I'm patriotic. I really am grateful that I live in America. But I also realize that sometimes we've gone astray. Mm-hmm. And when I look at this word priorities, mm-hmm. it literally is nonsensical. Priority means the first thing. If you tell me about your list of 15 priorities, you're saying I have 15 the first thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well. That makes no sense. When the United Nations releases a list of their 163 priorities, it simply tells me they don't have a priority. Because if everything's a priority, then nothing is.
Yeah.
And so what I've looked at is, how do I prioritize my time so that I can be, you know, the best father, the best husband, you know, the best person for the people in my life? And unfortunately, we're at a time right now where we're not overindulgent with consumption. We are, but that's not the only problem. Over the last decade, we've really become distracted. Mm. You know, we carry around these weapons of mass distraction in our pocket, and everyone has access to our attention 24 hours a day.
Mm. Yep.
And we wonder why we're not able to focus on. We're not able to prioritize the things that we say are important. Mm. If you show me your calendar, I'll show you your actual priorities. You can make a list of the priorities, but if you're not spending time doing those things, then of course it's just a lip service priority. And what I try to do with my daughter in particular is show her that. Also, you're right about the brands and mm-hmm. especially with kids now. I think this probably started right around the 90s where brands were becoming a stand-in, mm-hmm. a shortcut. And we've talked about this a bit on our podcast. We did a podcast episode about fashion and obsession. And what we talked about on there is if you look back a couple generations, who was cool? It was the James Deans or the Marilyn Monroes or the Elvis or whomever. And you couldn't tell me what brand they were wearing.
Right.
It didn't matter what brand white t-shirt James Dean was wearing.
Yeah, that's there wasn't product placement in movies at that point to the extent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. And so I think what we have to do with our kids is show them what it actually means to be cool, what it actually means to be a human being with feelings and not try to take these shortcuts, because these shortcuts don't actually get us where we want to go.
That's true. Huh.
That's great.
Yeah. How has becoming a minimalist changed the way you look at things?
Well, I think that I'm constantly questioning.
Are you? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so much so that it's no longer a cerebral exercise. It's more of a visceral exercise. Huh. And what I mean by that is, it used to be that I would go to a store, and if I saw something that was beautiful or that I liked that I wanted to acquire, well, then I would just buy it. And if I didn't have the money to buy it, I put it on a credit card and bring it home with me. And thinking that was going to satiate my unquenchable thirst for consumption. Mm-hmm. But of course, it never did. It just made me want the new thing.
Right.
There's this concept of object A. We're always sort of chasing whatever the new object A is, the thing that's going to make us complete. For some of us, that means if I just buy my dream home, then I'll be complete. If I buy that new Lexus, then I will be complete. If I get that sweater, then I will feel complete.
Right.
We always have this new object A, but realizing that we're always going to lack that completeness if we are trying to complete ourselves through material acquisition, realizing that you're already complete and therefore anything else is just sort of an adornment on top of that. And so when I go to a store now, instead of saying, well, I'm just going to buy this thing, it's more like I'm asking myself questions about this. Will this thing add value to my life? Is this the best use of this money? Can I afford it? And when I say afford it, I don't mean can I afford the price tag? That's only part of the cost. We never think about the true cost of our things. Can I afford to take care of the thing, to water the thing, to change the batteries in the thing, to put oil in the thing, to charge the thing, to clean the thing, store the thing, replace the thing, repair the thing? There are all of these additional costs that we never think about, but there's so many costs that go way beyond the price tag. And when we think about all of those costs, quite often it starts to make that thing far less appealing.
True, man.
So good.
Yeah.
Well, Josh, thank you for this has been fantastic, and we will post links to your books and the show and everything in our show notes. But I'm so grateful for you taking time. This has really continued to open up my mind to this way of thinking and challenged, I think that's the thing. You look at yourself and go, I've been doing something, whether I see it or not, a deliberate way for, as many years as I've been alive. And so it's good to once in a while have that challenge to go, you know what? I should probably look at these things. So
Robert's getting rid of his orange sweater today.
Yeah. I'm going to get rid of my red sweater. It's junk from what I hear.
No, this is so good. So good.
Yeah. So thank you so much for being with us, and look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Yes.
Well, I just want to acknowledge you and what you're doing. I'm really grateful for it. And thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. That was fantastic. I feel a little convicted.
yes.
I've got a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's relative to other people. It's not a lot of stuff. And I'm not talking about necessarily all valuable stuff. I'm just talking about stuff. And still I have this appetite to buy tennis shoes like all the time.
You have some cool ones though. I'm just going to say that.
I love shoes, but yep. I'm just looking at myself. Okay. When is it enough? And so this conversation was really insightful for me. And like I said, convicting, mm-hmm. but you know what I noticed about the whole thing is there is a spiritual principle to everything that he was talking about, mm-hmm. about live simply and yes. to just appreciate what you have. And maybe more important than just where we attach value to from an external standpoint, valuing the people in our lives, the things that really deserve our attention. This has been a constant theme mm-hmm. of our finance discussions, like talking to Chris Hogan, talking yep. about valuing and the presence that we're giving. And so the idea is simplifying our life down to the not just essentials, but non-essentials that are valuable, that bring value.
Right? Yeah. And it made me kind of think too, when he was talking, like we need to be okay with who we are. I feel like we're constantly buying things or like maybe as a woman just, well, this will make me feel better or this will make me look better or this will make me like, I'll be more likable if I have this. And actually we just need to be who we are, like, and just be content. And maybe we need to focus more on, like you just said, what can we do for people? What am I doing with my kids or for my kids? Like not buying the stuff, just in who are we as people? Who has God asked me to be? Hugging the person that's lonely or calling up and encouraging someone's heart. It was just, actually, someone did that for me today. I got a beautiful voice text message today that I didn't even know I actually needed, except it made me cry because it was just so beautiful. Yeah. Hey, I'm just thinking about you today. And I'm like, oh my goodness, someone's thinking about me today. Like maybe, I don't know, Robert, this was convicting to me too. Like maybe we need to reframe our days and what matters.
Right.
What matters.
Right.
And
stop comparing ourselves.
Stop the comparing.
To everybody else. And I know as a single mom or dad, you know, having had, I'm not even saying an abundance, but certainly probably more than you've got right now. Mm-hmm. You look around at your friends and you think they've got more. I'm going to say something that I hope it doesn't come off weird because I am remarried. Mm-hmm. But there's a part of me that understood the value of things mm-hmm. more when I didn't have as much stuff as I have now. I'm not even talking about material possessions. I'm talking about having a wife mm-hmm. and having things more quote unquote put together.
Yeah.
There's something beautiful about, we talk about this all the time, when things are stripped away, it makes you appreciate the things that really are of value. And I know this doesn't have anything to do with finances, but the principle will carry over into finances. If we're not always trying to rush after the new thing or compare ourselves to the married couples that are out there or even the way we used to have it, to be content with what we have. One of the quotes that I mentioned, I think the end was so good. He said, you do have control over your spending and you do have control over having less. And having less will automatically stretch what you do have. So the things that you have in your possession now, if you're more content with that and you don't spend as much, you don't go after it, you will find ways that are creative to stretch what you've got.
You will. And I actually think it has a lot to do with gratitude also. We're just more thankful for what we have. Listen, I did not have money. I did not. I just was a single mom that I worked hard. I paid all the bills, but I didn't have extra. We shopped at every thrift store. All of my furniture was from the thrift store, but it was beautiful. Mm. You know what? One of the best things I love to do, I used to sing at my old church in Canada. And I had this friend, we love thrift stores, you know, and actually one of our goals was to see if we could do better than the other one to see how little our outfit cost that day.
Like, that's good.
This whole outfit was $6. And it's like, we still had great things. We still looked great, but you know what? You can live on less and be grateful and live still a good life.
That's why we called the episode, you know, live more with less.
With less,
because, and we, you know, we thought about it as a leadership team. Should we talk about cutting coupons and stretching our money and money hacks and that kind of thing? And there's a place for that for sure. But like everything that we talk about, the fundamental, like how we view things and how we frame everything, we felt was more important when it came to simplifying and stretching our money because there is more to experience even in the midst of less.
Totally. Totally. Oh, thank you guys for being here and for listening. We are seriously so grateful that you just kind of hang out with us.
Absolutely.
And we we've walked the journey. We don't know all the answers. And a lot of this stuff we're learning, even at this season in our lives. And we're just glad that you're here on the journey with us. And so if you haven't already, do subscribe, like Robert said earlier, on the new Access More podcast platform or wherever you get your podcasts. There's so many great places that the kids still try to teach me about. We just don't ever want you to miss an episode. We are here. Our mission is just to provide you with resources, a great community, and support. So please be sure to check out the show notes for links and all that good information.
That's right. And so we would also love to connect and hear your questions or comments, your thoughts, and just how you're doing on social media. Join our community. If you go to Instagram or Facebook, just type in Solo Parent Society and you'll find us. We'd love to have you be part of this community with us. Mm-hmm. Listen, if this podcast has meant anything to you, I want you to consider being a partner with us financially. I know that we're talking about money this month and money is scarce. Yeah. Any little bit that you would want to contribute or you feel led to contribute on a monthly basis would be a tremendous help to us to help us continue doing what we do. We love doing this. We consider it an honor, but we are 100% donor driven. So if it pops into your mind and God is convicting you about wanting to sow into something that has meant something to you, we would be honored if you'd consider that. In the meantime, I want to leave you with our Solo Parent Society guiding verse, and that is Isaiah 41:10. It says, "So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you, and I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." Thanks so much for being a part of this, and we will see you here again next week.
Yeah.
See ya.